take as long as you like. We've got clock time, 20, 30 minutes. Sneak up on me and I'll point when I hear you. And he would do that and get so into it. And then I'd be like, well, why don't we swap? And he just ended up sitting, kind of doing a sit spot. But because it was a sneaking game, we did it. And it was terrific to do that. I really enjoyed that.
Welcome to the Tracking Connections podcast, and thanks for listening.
We feature voices from around the world sharing stories of working intentionally with deep nature connection in ways that transform lives, families, projects, and communities. I'm Sarah.
I'm Aiden.
And I'm John.
And we are your hosts from Living Connection First.
Hi, everyone. Sarah here with John and Jack Dirtnall from Sussex, UK.
Hi, everybody.
Hello, Jack. Yes, John here. And Jack is someone I met in 2017 at Embercomb. Mac McCartney was the founder of that place. And he's also the founder of the Children's Fire, which has sent out quite a concentric ring. And he wrote a lovely book about that, that I wrote the foreword to, actually. But yeah, no, it's nice to have Jack here. I met Jack at this Introduction to Art of Mentoring in 2017 with some really great skilled people there. But then, you know, you really got on my radar, Jack, when we were at, I think, the Art of Mentoring at Green and Away in Herefordshire or somewhere like that, when there was some great music going on. And you just struck me as this incredibly talented improvisationalist on your instrument. And I don't know, there was just something. I'm like, oh, I got to stay in touch with this guy, you know? And I'm glad we have, because you've been part of Village Talk for years and you're part of our village, the Living Connection First Village. And we've been sharing back and forth about bird language through our WhatsApp channel over the years, and I've really enjoyed getting to know you over the years, and you know, hearing about what you do, because I know you've got such a big heart, and you're just so kind and so helpful, and I always think about how lucky the children are that you work with through Cultivating Curiosity. That's one program you serve, and the Children's Forest with Anna Richardson and Sacred Earth. I mean, all these programs that you serve, you do a lot for a lot of people. Tell us a little bit about you.
Oh, thank you, John. Thank you, Sarah. And really lovely to be on this conversation. Yeah, I'm Jack from Forest Row, Sussex, UK. And after that Introduction to Art of Mentoring at Embercomb, and then doing the fantastic full Art of Mentoring 2017, it was Burnicombe Farm, John, in Devon. That was such a fantastic Art of Mentoring. My world kind of broadened dramatically with meeting lots of wonderful people that eventually drew me to live here in Forest Row and work with these programs that I do work for, and be part of this community that's really, really thriving. And I remember hearing wonderful stories when I was first listening to your podcast, John, about culture repair and the possibilities of that. And now I'm living that, and I'm so grateful for that. So it's wonderful to have been kind of fed that trail of breadcrumbs towards this through those wonderful stories of similar experiences for other people across the world.
Mm-hmm. And you've been at this for a while, and you're doing it year round. It seems like you're doing it most days of the week.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of, you know, working with children and probably some adults in a deep nature connection mentoring kind of way, you've taken to creating something called Folk Night. Tell us a little bit about that, because that's the people connection side. You're working with cultural elements there.
Yeah, well, my really lovely friend, Anna Richardson, who's a dear friend and a colleague, founder of the Children's Forest, she also founded Folk Night here, which is just thriving and fun and wonderful with Irish, Scottish, Welsh, English music, traditional folk music. And there's two of those. There's one where it's just tunes, one where there's lots of singing. It's wonderful for the community. People absolutely love it. And then inspired by that, but also inspired by jam nights that I used to go to when I was in my teens and 20s, I founded a jam night here that's like once a month, that is kind of soul, reggae, like kind of groove-based genres that are easy for people to play on chords-wise. And there's a fantastic collective of musicians here that were up for playing. And that has gone from strength to strength. And the people at the bar where we plays, like, a lot of them are like, oh, this is my favorite night we do. We've had that feedback, and people think it's getting better and better. So I love that. And it's kind of, I treat it like a kind of Trojan horse for connection, like just all the connection modeling that I've seen you and Sarah and Nate do, John, as part of the Connection First village. You know, there's so much that can subtly weave into things, and I just really enjoy bringing that in as part of Hop Jam, which is what it's called, because it's at the Hop Yard. And also it was lovely to hear Aidan talk about his experience with connection through music on this podcast as well a few months ago. I really deeply resonate with that, and I got so excited to hear Aidan describe those things.
Well, I hope someday that you and Aidan get to meet in person and play some music together.
That would be sweet. Yeah, absolutely. That'd be awesome. Because I think he comes to the UK, or he has a lot to do with the UK. I don't know the full story, but yeah.
Well, his wife was born in Cornwall, so they go. Yeah, they go back a lot to visit family, and you know, he'll be in your neighborhood. Well, I know
it's only exactly a 6-hour drive.
Yeah, exactly.
That would be lovely, though. I'd love that.
Well, I'll just say for the listeners that just a few days ago, I got a message from Jack, and he's often sending me lovely little videos or photos of things he saw in nature with some really nice greetings and gratitudes. And it's always uplifting to get a message from Jack. And he sends me this message, which I'll read to you, because it made me actually stop in my tracks. And I started thinking about it quite a bit after you asked this question. And I thought, you know what? I think this is something that I would love to record. Here, I'll read it to you. Jack says, I had this question a while ago, which I was reminded of tonight, having enjoyed listening to the Legacy of Connection mentoring stories, which is that's a storytelling session I shared last year in the service of a book. I got really curious what Tom was doing with the children who weren't as motivated as me. I started to find that a really interesting question, like in the context of how you had this amazing passion and drive that was helped by your grandmother and great aunt. So Tom could afford to mentor me, John, a certain way. But Jack got curious, what did Tom do with the other children who didn't have that kind of motivational mentoring? Maybe there's no big aha answer, but just found myself curious about that. Probably doing all the good stuff like trusting inner vision, inspiring stories, meeting them where they're at. Anyway, just a little curiosity thread and musing here. So this is Jack, and I'm going to pass it to Sarah.
Yeah, I just wanted to add some clarification for people who don't know who Tom is. Tom Brown Jr. is now an ancestor. He passed this past fall of 2024. But he was a teacher and mentor to John and a teacher to many, many people around not just survival skills, but how to thrive in connection with Mother Earth. And John was his first student. And what Jack is referring to is that John, as Tom said, was one of the only people that actually could have learned from grandfather. Those are the words of Tom, which, again, for people that don't know the background, I'll just summarize to say that John is incredibly passionate. You give John something to do and he's going to do it, right? He's super self-motivated. And there are many people that are like that, that, you know, that they're passionate about something. They're running toward it. You know, if you're guiding them, you just barely have to do anything, right? And they're going to go. And so we also recognize as mentors that not everyone does that. So, you know, not everyone, maybe they feel like they're interested. Maybe they're showing up saying, I'm really interested in this, but somehow that motivation isn't quite ignited. So this is a question that I've asked a lot, and not in that same framing. I love the framing of asking John, you know, specifically his experience of how did Tom work with the other people? Because the question that comes up for me is often, you know, how do I support this process? You know, or is it on me? What am I not doing enough of, right? How am I not showing up that's not being helpful to this person that I'm trying to mentor? Yeah, so I'll pass it over to you, Jack, if you want to add to your question and where you were coming from with that.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for reading the actual question as well. It was one of those questions that seemed so kind of blindingly simple when it arrived for me. But then it did get me thinking, like, well, I guess, like I said in the message, like, I wonder, but maybe the answer is just really simple. But I think I'm still glad we're asking it. But the drive behind the question, you were asking this before we started recording, John, and I'm interested to, because yes, I work with children. I also work with adults sometimes, and I love it. And I am curious how to motivate others, but also the most driving need is how do I motivate me? And that is like something that's been really driving me. It's like just being honest and transparent here. Like I was talking to Anna Richardson the other day and having a nice chat, and I was like, well, I believe in this stuff and I love it and I get so lit up when I hear stories about it. And yet sometimes I find it really hard to like remember to, I don't know, factor in the time to share my story or go to my sit spot or whatever it might be. Because when I do it, I love it. And, you know, I love journaling. Like when I get to do it, I'm like, this is awesome. And then I look at my journal, I'm like, oh, it was 2 weeks since I journaled. Whoa, how did that? It just seems like yesterday. But so it's that kind of question, that kind of feeling of need. It's like there's a need for this to reach people in a really good way. And I believe in this. I'm like a massive fan of all this stuff. And yet there's resistance in me that I can't shift and track. So I was curious in that, like, I imagine if I put myself in the mind of Tom, for instance, it's like, it's this wonderful experience to be able to pass on these things to you, John, in such an energy efficient way, because that energy channel has been opened up through the connection that runs in your family line and that love that passes through generations. So then when he doesn't have that facilitated in a way by a previous relationship with elders in these young people, did you notice him doing anything different? And what was that? Can you track that?
Mm-hmm, I can. You know, Tom introduced me in 1994 to a tracker class. And mind you, I met him in 71 when I was 10 years old. And he said, you know, in all my years, and this again was 1994 at the tracker school, he says, in all my years of doing what I'm doing, I've only met 5 people who could have learned from grandfather. And then he says, John Young, he is the only one I had the luxury to teach exactly the way grandfather taught me. He's one of them. And he's standing in the back of the room, which I didn't want him to do because I actually liked being anonymous, you know, because then I could just bond with the students and, you know, just be another person. But once he let the cat out of the bag, everybody was like swarming around me, asking me all kinds of questions that they hadn't really thought about before they started asking. So it sort of made the rest of the week unproductive in terms of, you know, I don't know, I became like a star instead of a human being who could help, you know, because people suddenly put me on this pedestal, which was very uncomfortable for me, which is why I asked Tom never to do that. He waited. He did wait, to his credit, from 1978 when he opened Tracker School to 1994. So I had a lot of anonymous time there, and I had a lot of great, you know, relationships and mentoring opportunities where I could be using, you know, the mentoring skills that Tom had passed on to me to subtly help guide the people at the tracker classes, you know. So, you know, grandfather was a Lipan Apache elder who essentially left his tribe to visit other cultures, other tribes, even checking out things like Chinese medicine and different things, because he was looking for universal elements that could help people really connect to Mother Earth in a really powerful way. He was all about awareness. And, you know, Tom, of course, being mentored by him since he was 6 years old, I imagine, you know, grandfather was a pretty compelling character. You know, I've gotten to know many Indigenous elders who were raised traditionally and who were very much in their culture, you know, between the San Bushmen and Gilbert Walking Bull and Jake Swamp and Judy Swamp and others, different parts of the world. The elders are compelling to children. There's just no way around that. So if an elder gives a child something to do, like my grandmother did when I was a boy, it was compelling for me. There was zero resistance on my part, because one, she wasn't just bossing me around, but she would lightly suggest, Nanny Cecil, my Irish grandmother, hey, if you could go catch some fish for dinner, I'd be happy to clean them with you, Jonathan, and we could cook them for dinner, and that would be wonderful. So off I go, because I know when I come back, not only is she going to do what she said, she lifts me up for contributing. She values what I'm doing, right? She sees me, she hears me, and even more, she asks me all kinds of questions when I get back about which way did I go? Hey, just in case Nanny ever wants to go visit that pond, tell me how to get there. How did you get there? You know, and so she's making me recite a verbal map. And there was so much that grandmother did for me as a boy. And my great aunt from the Polish side, she taught me the value of silence in nature. We often took long, silent, very meditative walks. She was a very powerful woman. She held this field of connection and silence that was just profound. And it was so easy as a boy to just slip right into that field with her. And so when I met Tom, these were two things that he was looking for. Because, you know, what does it mean to be able to learn from grandfather? You know, when he said that in 94, I started thinking about it all spiritually and, you know, like, oh, there must be some special thing about me. But no, the answer is that if we had grandmothers, grandfathers, uncles, aunts, that since we were little, sent us on errands and caught our stories and occasionally did things with us in the bush, we would be super motivated. You know, like, it's a natural for a child to want to do that kind of stuff. And the more they do it, and for me, it was almost daily for many years of my childhood, it's like this big old concrete flywheel inside me starts to move slowly at first. And with every, you know, successful errand or even unsuccessful errand, sometimes they were even more interesting because of the kinds of questions I would get from my grandmother. You know, that flywheel, every time there's an activity like that, and that cycle is completed, me going out and doing something, me coming back and having my story caught and deepened, that's what gets that flywheel going. That's all it means. To be able to learn from grandfather means that you are self-motivated and you're passionate and you're curious and you just want to run out there and do stuff, you know? So grandfather had told Tom when he left to go on his final walk when he was very old to look for Tom's first student, and he'll know that student by the sign he carries. And Tom spent 3 years looking at children around him in New Jersey and just never saw what he was looking for in those children. And when he met me, he saw something in me, came back to the house with me, helped my dad clean a big snapping turtle that I had caught. That was the sign. I had Mother Earth on a string, according to Tom. I didn't know that at the time. I had a common Eastern snapping turtle on a line. Tom came back to my house. He went down into my nature museum where I had my menagerie of all kinds of wild animals and, you know, terraria with little plants and a kiddie pool with turtles and fish. And he asked me zillions of questions. And I was able to answer all of them to such detail. And he asked me where I got it and how I got it. And he started to see that I had that motivation. He could see what my grandmother had done for me. And he just picked it up right there. And of course, his errands were so much more involved and so much more progressive. And, you know, by the time I was 18, I knew all the tracks and sign of all the animals. I could follow the animals. I knew where they were denning. I knew all the bird language, the plants and the trees and, you know, the basic survival skills. All cultivated through this errand method. Send me out to do something. I come back and tell him about it. He asks me questions. He catches me out where I'm not aware, makes me be more aware every time. And it just grew and grew and grew. He did that with me for about 2 years when he started to realize that I was really growing in a profound way. And he wanted there to be more young people that he could influence. He's like, okay, well, this is working really well with John, right? So I'm going to take over this Boy Scout troop that's about to go defunct. The scoutmaster has to leave the area because he got transferred by his job. And there was no one stepping up to take over that Boy Scout troop. And there's probably 12 young people in there, ranging in age from 12 to 17. And they didn't want their troop to break up. And so Tom and his brother, Jim Brown, took over that troop. Now, Jim was super into the Boy Scouts. You know, he was an Eagle Scout. He went to Philmont Camp in New Mexico every year. And, you know, he was super into the Scout model. Tom was into a different Scout model. Grandfather was a Scout of a different nature, an Apache Scout. So it was interesting to see the hybrid between the Boy Scout model and the Apache Scout model. Tom, of course, led the Apache Scout side and Jim led the Boy Scout side. So Tom instructed me to recruit young people to join the troop. So friends of mine who weren't in the other two troops in our town, I would, you know, say, hey, you know, there's this cool guy and he's been working with me for the last couple of years. He's a lot of fun. We do really cool stuff in the Pine Barrens. We camp a lot. You know, you should join. And little by little, I got my friends to join. And so that made it really fun. But what Tom discovered pretty quickly is right to the point of your question, Jack. My friends weren't they didn't have that flywheel motivation going. They didn't have that upbringing with their grandparents. They even made fun of me for all the time I spent, you know, in my menagerie, you know, with my critters. But they were entertained by it, but they thought I was a little bit obsessive, you know. When Tom gave them little things to do, very few of them did it. Like, none of them had a sit spot. That was the first thing that Tom made me do. And for the listener, I thought you'd appreciate that Jack is actually recording this from his sit spot there in Forest Row in Sussex. And he was sharing stories about the barn owls around his place and the voles that he saw. And he was showing Sarah and I, you know, through this camera where he was and the beautiful silver birch tree he was leaning against. And, you know, Jack said he's not motivated, but yet here he is having the conversation from his sit spot. So I would say you have some motivation, Jack. But, you know, the bottom line was that almost none of those young people that Tom wanted to get a sit spot, or what he came later to call the sit area, none of them were doing it. And I could tell Tom was a little frustrated with the young people that were kind of, they seemed interested in nature. They loved camping. They, you know, they loved what we were doing, but none of them followed up between our troop meetings or between our camping trips. Like, and I could see Tom struggling to figure out how to motivate them. I think he thought he would get a bunch of me's that would just automatically just do whatever he asked them to do. And so, yes, I mean, you made some suggestions. You know, maybe he was just doing storytelling, meeting them where they were at, using inner vision. Well, Tom told Sarah and I in the last 3 years that he always leans on inner vision when working with people. So we know that he did that. And what is inner vision? Sarah, how would you explain inner vision to someone who doesn't know what we're talking about?
I guess I would simply call it the intuitive mind, listening beyond our own personal intellect, you know, in connection with the question at hand. How is that?
Yeah, that's good. And I would just add one thing to it, which is that, you know, if your mind is quiet and you're in this kind of, I'm not thinking about what I'm going to do with this child in front of me, I'm just trying to be very present and I'm listening. I'm listening beyond sound. I'm listening to their heart. I'm listening to my own heart. And I don't have a thought in my head, but suddenly something pops in my mind. Maybe it's a story that I should tell, or maybe it's an activity I should do. I don't know where it comes from, but it pops in there suddenly, like a little download from the quiet place within. And if I trust that, it's always the right thing at the right time. So that Tom emphasized in his last 3 years of teaching that that was really important to this kind of teaching, this kind of mentoring. So he did tell us that that was part of it. So I'm sure, Jack, a lot of the stuff that he did to get these young people motivated was coming from inner vision. I don't doubt that. So what Tom started to do was he would bring, for one thing, he did these games. He used so many games. Our troop meeting was, I think it was either Monday night or Tuesday night every week at this little community hall in our local town. You know, it had like a little kitchen in the back and just a big room, and folding chairs that went in a closet, folding tables that went in a closet. There was a bunch of coat hangers in the closet. And this all matters, actually, because Tom decided that these young people were going to learn the ways of the scout from grandfather's lineage, not just the way of the scout from the Boy Scout lineage. And what he did was he started to set up these games where he had us go in the closet, pull out all the folding tables, pull out all the folding chairs, pull out all the coat hangers, and basically build a chaotic barrier out of them. So don't picture them all nice and neat. Picture them on this table's on its side. This table's only got one side set up of legs. So it's on a weird angle. There's folding chairs piled up on top in all these weird and random ways. Coat hangers hanging all over the place. The chairs are metal. The tables have metal legs. You know, they've got these press board, you know, tops with a formica coating on them, you know, so they could be used for all kinds of things because there were sewing circles there, you know, potlucks and stuff like that. So basically making what looked like an impenetrable barrier across the room. And then on the other side of the barrier, on the kitchen side of the barrier, there's a folding metal chair facing the barrier. And then there's cups, like a coffee cup from the kitchen, a porcelain coffee cup with spoons and forks and knives in it that rattle very easily underneath the chair. And one of us is placed in the chair with a blindfold, and everybody else is on the other side of the barrier. And there's maybe 20 of them. And now what they have to do, the lights go off. Now they have to stalk quietly using fox walking, which he taught them. They have to find a way either through that barrier, over that barrier, under that barrier, without knocking a coat hanger, without causing a chair to shift. And the person in the chair with the blindfold is now pointing whenever they hear a sound. And Tom's brother, Jim, is standing there like the referee. He sees the person who made the noise. He sends them back to the back of the room and tells them they have to stand and watch and wait until he gives them permission to start going again. And boy, that was difficult. But week after week, hour after hour, everybody got better and better and better at this. They practiced being perfectly still. They practiced moving very slow and fluid. They learned mastery over their bodies. They would get through the barrier. Their instruction was to get a spoon out from under the person sitting there with the blindfold or a fork or a knife, lift it without making a sound, and carry it back over the barrier. And if they got back and handed it to Jim or Tom on the other side of the barrier, then they won that round. Then they would be blindfolded and put in that chair, and their job would be to point things out. So if you look at all the coyote teaching in this, all of the ways that these young people are now being trained to move slow, to be still, to find silence, to be totally aware using all their senses, this was an activity that he did with us week after week after week after week for months. Everybody got so good at it that Tom had to keep upping the ante and making it more and more difficult. Then he brought us into the backyard of this place where there was dry leaves and sticks and did the same game out there without the barrier. And then when we were in the Pine Barrens camping, we played these kinds of games late into the night where he would create teams and basically capture the flag. And there was all this time in stillness. And then we would do it during the day, and there'd be all this time and stillness in nature. So this is how he got them all to slow down to earth time, to connect to the land, and to actually begin to embody this connection with nature that then they started to naturally over the years practice at home. I kept hearing stories from Mike Janico and Hank and how they all had sit spots now. And, you know, like, but it didn't happen fast. It was those games that got them to begin to embody these skills. And they all got really good at it. They got really good at it, both indoors and outdoors. And then Tom would take us on these really fun adventures. And we'd see people camping, and we would sneak up on them without being seen and watch them from the shadows and then sneak away, you know, and then to tell the story. How many people are in the camp? What kind of gear do they have? Are they drunk? You know, if they're drinking, what are they drinking? You know, like, who's smoking? Are they right-handed? Are they left-handed? He would do all these kinds of fun things where we had to come back and report in every detail, you know, how many men, how many women, you know, whose tracks, you know, have gone outside the light of the fire, you know, and which person has that footprint, you know, and it was really cool. And then he would have us sneak up on deer, and then he would have us sneak up on frogs in the water, and we would have to practice being herons in the swamp, walking really slow, and then getting down in the water and trying to become eye level to frogs that are singing at night, you know, like all these mad adventures that the kids just loved. But it built slowly over time, and he built it on the foundation of those skills of moving and being silent and having to be still for long periods of time. And once that got embodied, then it naturally transferred to the outdoors. Then they became naturally interested. Yes, you also said inspiring stories. He told many inspiring stories around the fire at night. He pulled stories out of us. We laughed. he made told a scary story, so he got scared, you know, and then he challenged us to do things like, hey, I'll challenge one of you guys. I have a $20 bill in my hand. I'll give it to whoever's willing to walk around that lake after he told the scary story. And then a bunch of people would stand up to volunteer, he say, alone, without a flashlight. They'd all sit back down, you know. So he was always kind of challenging that youthful adventure to see where we were at, you know, like that was how he measured. And I have to say that, you know, when I was 19, the one thing I want to say that not all of them fully embraced this path in the way that I did. But I will say this, when I was 19 and we were sitting around a fire, the troop had disbanded back in 1977. Tom went off to write his first book and opened his school in 78. He moved to a different part of the state. All of the people that grew up with him and played these games and did all these camping things. And Tom never tried to foist his philosophy or his values on us. He let us each kind of come to our own conclusions. All of those young people, when I was 19, sat around a fire one night. There's probably five or six of us. And every one of them was deeply concerned for the development that was happening, for the loss of habitat, for the disconnection of the people around them from nature. You know, they were all embodying this felt sense of loving the earth and wanting to care for it for the future and being really sad and angry about the changes that were happening on the landscape around us as our childhood forest adventure places were being developed and turned into neighborhoods and shopping malls. You know, they were really upset by it and legitimately, like from a deep place. So I could see that Tom did reach them, even though none of them went on to do what I do. But, you know, that they all had their paths in life, and I've stayed in touch with a lot of them over the years, and they're all still very much actively concerned and working for local volunteer organizations to help nature and birding and, you know, feeding the birds and taking care of the forest. And, you know, they all have that side to them. So it worked, bottom line. Yeah, and I wonder if you have reflections on that, Jack.
I mean, it's lovely to hear those stories. Because I remember you piquing my interest a while ago in one of the story shares talking about these types of games. And I like hearing more detail about them. I mean, I really celebrate that in these parts, I just want to hold up Phil Greenwood, who founded Sacred Earth and the Earth Steward Apprenticeship Program, as being someone who I've seen pull that off here. Because that's the only place in my experience I've seen what you're talking about there, John, with those types of games, with late night in the dark games of trying to sneak back into the fire circle and take being in two teams and take it in turns to spot for the others, spending ages doing a belly crawl in the dark, like towards the fire circle. And it's wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And I'm glad that I've witnessed and been part of that working for someone who, a young 14-year-old who came to the ESA program, Earth Steward Apprenticeship program, and he was finding it really, really hard. He kind of, I think he has been diagnosed as having ADHD, and he does take special medicines, but he found it, he was kind of had almost a phobia of sit spot when everyone else would go. He'd be like, no, don't make me go, I can't sit still, I don't want to do it. And I'd be like, we don't have to. And I thought of this workaround where I said, well, why don't we just sneak up on each other while everyone else is having a sit spot? And so I just went and sat at my sit spot at Sacred Earth and I said, you take as long as you like. We've got clock time, 20, 30 minutes. Sneak up on me and I'll point when I hear you. And he would do that and get so into it. And then I'd be like, well, why don't we swap? And he just ended up sitting, kind of doing a sit spot. But because it was a sneaking game, we did it. And it was terrific to do that. I really enjoyed that because I'd seen how gifted he was previously, this particular young man, and really admired and respected him, and just wanted to enable him to be there in the best way he could, because I loved and appreciated him for that. So I was glad that works in that context as well. But the whole power of games, and I like that you're not referencing just any game. These are all games where it's very focused. It's kind of really dropping in. It's slowing down. It's slowing down almost to the point of immersive sit spot in movement. That's a very cool seed to take away from the conversation for me as well. Yeah, thank you.
There was something else he did that I'm realizing now. He would say to us, well, first of all, he took everybody on this really fun, adventurous camping trip, okay, almost right away. So as soon as all these new people joined the troop, we went on this really fun, adventurous camping trip with lots of swimming holes and different cool things that we did. All these fun trail rides that we did with his Jeep, where he would pull a mattress behind the Jeep through the sand and a bunch of us would pile on and he would drive and we would just laugh and have so much fun and we'd take turns. And so he, first of all, showed us that he was capable of showing young people a really good time. That was number one. Then after that camping trip and we get back home again, then he says to us the next Monday or Tuesday night, like I said, I don't remember if it was Monday night or Tuesday night. He says to us at the troop meeting, okay, I want to get you guys ready for another camping trip, but I'm not going to take you until I see that you have developed some skill in stalking and awareness. And that's why those games on Tuesday nights went on for weeks before he took us camping again. So he was holding out camping like a reward, right? And so that was motivating, I think. So he did do that. And the other thing he did was, if people really showed up and did the skills and really showed interest in the skills, he would take them as a subgroup on special adventures. And then we'd all come back and tell our story. Cause I went on every single one of those special adventures cause I was always doing all the stuff. So he would lift up the role models by giving them extra benefits in a sense, right? Like, you have to earn your way into this group, you know, this guild within the troop. And that actually motivated a lot of people. There was four people in particular that got very motivated to do stuff in between meetings at home so they could practice and then be invited on these special missions and adventures, right? Then his brother would stay back with the rest of the troop and they would do cool stuff too, right? There was always cool stuff going on. Everyone got to do cool stuff. But the ones that were less motivated were actually watching us, those who were motivated, watching us. I could feel them watching us. I could feel their resentment a little bit, you know, their jealousy, whatever you want to call that. But it was a healthy way to model something, right? And that also had an effect on the others. And I don't think that naturally would apply to every program and every kid. But, you know, just to kind of lay that out there as well.
Totally. Yeah. And I just want to state one obvious thing to tease out a theme is like the power of overnights and the power of the dark and that sort of rite of passage of meeting that is woven into those stories quite a lot. And that's a very powerful motivating factor, an edgy factor for teens and preteens. I've seen that too. And it's lovely to hear that within those stories. Yeah.
Well, and also the relationship that each of us as individuals built with our own skills to tend fire. Because he would challenge us to sit by our fire at night at our sit spot at home by ourselves and tend that fire for several hours and then come back and tell him about it. You know, so there was this subgroup of the overall troop that did that kind of stuff regularly. And then that naturally caused us to get together as teens to have fires in the forest and hang out together where all the other kids were off partying in someone's basement, you know. We were sitting by a fire under the stars and sharing stories with each other, you know, and that was all cultivated through these practices from Tom.
Yeah. So I'm hearing a couple threads here. If we're looking at that question, how do we work with other people or ourselves if we don't have quite enough motivation to create a pattern or to go deep on a journey? So I'm hearing that intrinsic motivation and also right timing. Like all the stories that you shared about games, it's like, there was a place that was found that was interesting, right? And then there was also the time that it took to embody the game, right? To really get into it. So it wasn't like we just do one thing and then we're done. It was like, we're doing this for a while and having that patience where I feel like often in our society, there's an expectation that it's kind of immediate, right? That we get ready and we go. And our nervous systems aren't necessarily trained as a child growing up through conventional school systems to take the time to slow down, to sit still, to build awareness, right? It's like such an interesting story, Jack, of your friend with ADHD of, you know, being, I don't want to sit still. I'm just imagining him, like, where are the places where he's had to sit still? You know, like, I can't sit still in a, like, mall or something like that, you know, or maybe there's been too much time on computers where the focused energy is like so intense for so long. And anyway, my point being that things do take time, and in the natural learning cycle, maybe we all haven't had enough time where we're in the midday in that deep relaxation, that deep integration place where we can then find a place of centeredness and relaxation where motivation then emerges naturally. And maybe, you know, when we're working with other people and even ourselves, we really need to acknowledge that we need to rest and integrate, and we need to intentionally build things into our life that we want, right? So if we're talking about journaling, that was something that you brought up, Jack, like there's obviously a motivation there. And then maybe it's like we need to retrain ourselves to find that place of motivation. Like, you know, people were showing up to Boy Scouts regularly, right? Their parents were dropping them off. They almost kind of don't have a choice. As adults, it's like, well, we have a choice, and we have to take charge of that choice, right? To whatever, make a plan of once a week I'm going to journal, or twice a week I'm going to journal, and remember to feel the reasons why I want to journal. And then also having that patience around right timing. Like, John, your story of, you know, the people that were really interested got invited on certain trips. I feel the wisdom in that. Why would you bring people that aren't ready to a place, right? Or into an experience? So like we, as a mentor or a teacher or maybe parent, guardian, we might have a tendency to say, oh, I should do more for you. Look, this is really fun. Maybe we start to dish off more than people are actually ready for, instead of acknowledging that, oh, they haven't even digested, right, what we have given them so far. So instead of overwhelming or like trying to motivate them, right, which can go absolutely the other way sometimes, you know, so you try to motivate somebody that's not motivated, they often will dig their heels in, right? So can we be wise enough to pull back and say, maybe they need less, maybe they need to relax, maybe they need a tiny bit of motivational material, or maybe they just need time and space to be, so they can even relax enough to tune into what they truly want, what they're motivated by. I feel like there's so much externalized motivation, right? Where we're told we need to do things based on a society that's not necessarily natural.
Yeah, those are good reflections. I want to add two more games that Tom loved to play with us at night in the Pine Barrens. One of them was a blindfold drumstock. And the other one was a blindfold string walk. So, you know, instead of using the drum, he would set up a pathway with a piece of string all through the woods, through thickets, over logs, through swamps, you know, and then we'd all be blindfolded and we'd have to follow the string because you have no idea where it's going because, you know, he deliberately doesn't tell you where it's going. You know, we all have to wait over here while he sets up the string. And then when it's time, he gets us in our blindfolds and then leads us to the place, right? So these blindfold exercises played a big role also when we were teens. And I, you know, looking back over it now, I just see the importance of that sensory development and how profound the connection is when we're blindfolded. And it's pretty cool. But I also wanted to point, you know, and I'm sure you know about this, Jack, in the back of Coyote's Guide to Connecting with Nature, there are a whole load of games that are fantastic. And a lot of them are based on the games that Tom did with us when we were young. And that's a great resource. And those games are designed to be modified, you know, so you have to look at them and then look at the situation you have and look at the group that you're working with and then make modifications to make those games work. But a lot of those games are designed to, you know, what Tom would call coyote teach, things like having inner silence, being able to move at the pace of the earth, being able to trust intuition, inner vision, like all these games build those qualities within a person over time. As Sarah said, it takes time. Sometimes the games would get repetitive to the point where it became like a rut. And then as soon as he saw that, he would change the rules, he would change the environment, he would change the time of day we did it. So he was always modifying the games to make them fit, you know, always stretch us further, right? That, like, as soon as we got good at one level, he would add something else. Then I think that's also important. As Sarah said, maybe you're just adding one little thing at a time, right?
Mm-hmm. I want to say that I also really believe the game itself, like you've alluded to this, John, and you kind of almost said it directly, but the game itself, there is a huge wisdom in what the actual, where he's actually bringing you, right? That blindfolded drum stock, I was so resistant to doing that at my, was it advanced tracking class in 2016? I was like, there is no way. It was raining. He told us we needed to get in our bathing suits. He didn't tell us we had to, but everyone else, you know, like 60, 70 people are running to get their bathing suits on to go blindfolded at night through the rain to find this drum beat, right? And I'm like looking around like, these people are crazy. They're like brainwashed. So I finally do it and I get to the line and we're all lined up to, the drum is, sounds like it's a mile away. It's probably only a quarter mile away. I don't really know. And I'm like, standing in line with all these people, put my blindfold on, and I took probably three steps before I dropped into like, wow, this is cool. And I had the most beautiful experience. I could hear not everybody was having that experience by the thrashing and the cursing. But what it did to me, it dropped me deep into my nervous system in a really beautiful way. And so I just want to name that. Like you said, it's not just any game. There's like, where is this game bringing us? And I think probably so many games have places that they bring us that we're not completely aware of. But anyway.
Brilliant. I mean, I'm so pleased you're both mentioning these blindfold games. And Sarah, it just really made me think like there's blindfold drumstocks and there's blindfold drumstocks. And that sounds like a whole different level. Because I mean, I'm thinking about a day group with home educated kids where you're there from like 10 till 3 and you've got the kids, and how can we bring in these essences that we've distilled here? And I'm really thinking blindfold activities, because actually, as it happens, me and Anna Richardson co-run a Wednesday group with home educated kids, and we've been actually using that lovely offering you put out, John, 5 years ago, the original Connection First audios. That was a free, very generous free offering during the pandemic. And we've been using that as part of our planning each week. And we got to the point of that tactile sense, going to one sit spot and really just closing our eyes and going into tactile sense. And then we both got excited to start gearing them towards eventually going to their sit spots blindfolded from the center point of our little mini village, which is our camp we go to each week. And so we're kind of working them towards that, and it's been really fun. Because I must say, this is also a thing that group this time last year, it was like, oh, sit spot, I don't want, oh, it's boring. And we were like, no, how can we, how did that happen? And me and my friend Rhiannon, who I actually work with as well in a lovely forest school in London called Kinship in Nature, we're really good friends, we were like, we can't, this is in a different context but same story, can't let sit spot get boring. We have to reinvent sit spot for these particular kids. She found this owl feather in that site, and we spun this whole story that was real about the owl and the amazing senses the owl possesses. And so we re-coined it as the secret owl spot. So can you go to your secret owl spot? And it has this, I mean, actually, as we are speaking, from when you mentioned your grandmother, John, and your great aunt and Tom, the barn owl came 20 feet from here, the closest I've ever seen them. And now they're in the coniferous tree that I pointed out at the beginning. So it's lovely having the owl bless this conversation. So we recoined it Secret Owl Spots, and really, you know, I wrote this whole poem that we read before we go, and like really dropped them into becoming the owl. And we just kind of worked ourselves up, me and Rhiannon, and then in a different context, me and Anna, into like really getting into it ourselves. And then it's so exciting to bring that layer now to the Wednesday group of, okay, we've got these secret owl spots. It's been fantastic. It's brought a new lease of life to it. So much connection. Now, can you go there, you know, firstly, with your eyes closed, you know, you're allowed three little snapshots with your eyes as if you're taking a picture, and the shutter opens and closes, and you get three of those on the way there, you get three on the way back, because it's really difficult to do that. But, you know, we did it last week, and now we're going to build them up to doing that blindfold. So I'm just grateful that it's reminded me of that little story, because, you know, these themes that you're sharing, John, from that experience, those experiences with Tom, I'm really hearing the power of having overnights, and kind of the power of fun, the power of the dark, and not being able to see the power of that camaraderie and shared social value. And all of that is really, it's really getting me excited. And there must be little ways like that. And I was like, oh, but how do I do that with a day group? But then I was like, oh, we kind of are, and we can just hold that up more. So I'm really grateful for those realizations.
Great stuff, Jack. Well, we know it's going to work. I think all three of us can feel, right? When we were working with a group of teens, probably in the 90s there, we did that. We worked with this homeschool group 3 days a week, and it eventually went to 4 days a week. And they all had to go to their sit area, because we would do bird sits, and then they would come back and tell us what they saw, right? And we would map it. And every week we upped the ante. We did the same thing you did, where they can do three snapshots, you know, open their eyes three times on the way to their sit spot. And eventually they quite all took to it, to the point where they wanted to go barefooted and they wanted to go fully blindfolded to and from their sit spot in a really thick Western Washington rainforest, you know, in the rain. And it was amazing to me how they kept rising to the challenges, and that they themselves upped the ante by suggesting things to make it harder for themselves. And they got so good at it, they were astounding. They were getting birds landing on them at their sit spot while they had their blindfolds on, and stories like that. It was just so magical, you know. So these games can really help. And again, as Sarah said, there's intentionality around the game. There's a purpose for the game. You know what it is. You know what skill they're lacking or what competency they're lacking. Maybe they're too fidgety or they're not comfortable in their bodies. So you do games to deepen that. But you have to spot the things that are blocking them from those attributes of connection and work out which game would help that, right? And set that intention as the leadership to stay with that game until you see the results, because it's neuromuscular patterning. It takes time, right? The nervous system has to respond. They might be, as Sarah said, reason he doesn't want to sit still is because he's been yelled at to sit still for so long. It's traumatic for him. So to build that relationship with a place until he feels comfortable, and then that little switch you did where you sneak up on me at my sit spot, and then I'll sneak up you on your sit spot. That was brilliant, Jack. That was brilliant.
So
that
he now does sit spots, by the way. Yeah, which is really cool.
I'm sure he does. Yeah. So that was probably your inner vision kicking in.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to add one more layer to the game idea, which Tom often did with us, right? So after a couple of years of working with us, and we're going to the Pine Barrens a lot, and when we have like 7 days off from school, we're going to the Pine Barrens for six of those 7 days, right? Like, so we're getting really into the survival skills and stuff. He would often say, okay, I want you guys all to imagine right now that this is it. We're the last people left on the earth. And now we have to figure out, how are we going to survive? What are we going to do? What are we going to eat? How are we going to keep ourselves sheltered? And he would constantly drop that little challenge game in. What if this was a real survival situation? What would we do now? And he would challenge us all to contribute to that. And then we would pretend for 3 or 4 days that we were in a survival situation. And that is amazing. And he would often do things like, pretend we're in enemy territory and we can't be seen, but we have to build a shelter and get a fire going, but not be detected. How are we going to do it? So he would add these fun, intriguing layers to the games we were playing. And he would make everything a game, which was very important to him. He called it the sacred game right up until he passed away. But that was a very important teaching method from Stalking Wolf as well, grandfather. So I just remembered that in hearing this last reflection. But really love this conversation, Jack. I so am thankful that you thought to ask that question. And it just led to such a rich conversation. And I really appreciate that.
Hmm. Yeah, me too. I mean, yeah, it's been beautiful to be part of that and hear all these, just get fired up with energy from hearing these stories and sharing all of this. Thank you, John, and thank you, Sarah, and all of you listening as well.
Yeah, thank you, Jack, and thank you, John. I feel there's something you said, Jack, around, you know, you and your colleagues getting really worked up about the game and getting excited about the game. And that, you know, that is so real. If it's not exciting to you, how is it going to be exciting to the kids, right? And also the mirror neurons that are firing off that happen. And I hear that obviously with Tom too. And I just know that of Tom, that his level of passion was, you know, off the charts, and that him bringing you into a survival situation in that way was just as much for him that it was for you all. So yeah, thanks everyone for tuning in.
Thank you all.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Tracking Connections. If you enjoy this podcast, it would mean a lot to us if you would take a minute to follow or subscribe. Following the podcast helps us, and it helps you because you'll never miss an episode. We'd also love for you to give us a 5-star rating and review and share an episode with a friend. To learn more about our current offerings, visit livingconnectionfirst.net. We'll see you next time.